Welcome to the Pyramid Podcast, where three lads discuss all things the English football pyramid. On today's episode, Liverpool beat Chelsea 2-1 at Anfield. Are they the real deal under Arne Slot? Arsenal have a third man sent off in 8 games as they lose 2-0 at Bournemouth. VAR was at the heart of the action again, but actually, were all the decisions correct? We'll have a roundup of the EFL action, including a good news story coming out of Wickham, and we'll finish with Laura, who talk us through Yeovil's 3-0 win at Wealdstone. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, and once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence. Boys, we want to start at Anfield. Liverpool win, stay top of the Prem. Goals from Mo Salah and Curtis Jones, either side of the Nicholas Jackson equaliser for Chelsea. Enough for the 3 points for Liverpool. Laura, are we now looking at genuine title contenders here in Liverpool?
Yeah, I think we are. Obviously, I said on Friday that this was a big game. I thought more so for Chelsea in the fact that if they could get 3 points at Anfield, then they would sort of announce themselves as proper troublers of the top two or three, if you like. But Liverpool have started on fire. The only game they've lost, they'll probably look back on and kick themselves because it was Forest at home and feel like that's massively dropped points. But I thought they looked quite comfortable against Chelsea yesterday. Although they're a good side and they had some chances, Liverpool, you never really felt were in danger of losing the game. And the big thing in regards to them is the run of fixtures that they've got coming up now, I think, is really difficult. So if they can come out the other side of that and still be where they are now, then they'll probably be favourites. But I think in the context of Rodri being out for Man City and Arsenal slipping up again at the weekend, you have to fancy them as being as favourites for the league as anyone at the moment, to be honest.
Tomo, you spoke on the last pod about being interested to see how Brian Gravenberch did against Cole Palmer, and I thought he had a great game, but actually seemed like Liverpool looked to deploy Curtis Jones a little bit more to take hold of Palmer as well as providing options going forward.
Yeah, he was everywhere, really. And Curtis Jones is someone who I have an irrational hate for. I don't really know why, other than the fact I think he sort of carries himself with this main character energy when he certainly hasn't sort of justified having that sort of energy just quite yet in his career. But obviously, if he carries on playing the way he did on Sunday, then he will justify it because he was all over the place. He was making last-ditch tackles, last-ditch blocks to deny Cole Palmer scoring, and then obviously he was involved in everything good that Liverpool did. Obviously scored the second goal, I think was involved in both penalty incidents, which I actually think both were penalties. And yeah, he's had a good week. He actually, I think his missus just gave birth a couple of days ago. So I think he was saying in his post-match press or post-match interview that he's been sleeping in the spare room to get some much needed shut eye, and it's clearly worked because he probably had one of the games of his life.
Yeah, right up there with his Liverpool games, I'm sure. And it just seems like under Slot they seem to have all of the sort of attacking presence that the Klopp sides had, but they seem to have way more control in midfield as well. Like Gravenberch was someone who, on early pods when it looked like they'd missed out on Zubimendi, that we called out, and I think we mentioned it on the last pod, as someone who might struggle and didn't look that great last year, but he looks to be like absolutely flourishing in this role in midfield. And Slot just seems to tweak it about a little bit, where it seems to be a bit less heavy metal and a little bit more controlled, and it seems to be working for Liverpool.
Yeah, and do you know what as well? It's quite interesting to see how quickly Liverpool have, as a team, have sort of they reflect their manager's like outlook and personality a bit. Like obviously with Klopp, he was very like erratic and very emotional and very motivational and just in your face and like you say, rock and roll football that he used to describe his style of playing, his philosophy with. Whereas Slot's come in and he's not really. He seems to come in with this composure, this calmness, even his press conferences, the way he's talking to the media, everything about it is reflecting in the way his team are playing. And it goes to show, really, that he was given quite a strong hand anyway, because Klopp's obviously stepped down and given him a very strong squad. But Slot's just come in, and rather than panicked and gone, oh, I need to stamp my authority very quickly because of how much of a god Jurgen Klopp is up here, he's just made one or two tweaks, and it's helped them become. It's definitely helped them become more defensively sound, and obviously their midfield's the star of the show. So, yeah, there's not really a lot you can criticise Slot or Liverpool for. They've won their first 10 out of 11 games, so they're flying high.
Yeah, a difficult week coming up for them. I think they're away in Leipzig on Wednesday in the Champions League, and then go to the Emirates on Sunday, which we'll obviously touch on Arsenal in a bit more detail in a bit.
Yeah, just before we move on from that game, I just wanted to mention Chelsea because it feels like it was a little bit of a crossroads moment, that game, in the sense of can Chelsea really mix it with the big boys? And really, it did feel a little bit like Liverpool, just a level above. And when you look at that Chelsea, they had obviously they had a really strong 11 out. But if you look at their bench, when you consider Ben Chilwell and Mikhailo Mudryk didn't even make the bench, they had Dewsbury Hall on the bench, Enzo Fernandez, João Felix, and Nkunku, that Vega who's come in and looked really impressive, De Sassi and Badiashile. Now, they've arguably got one of the strongest squads in the Premier League, and it'll be interesting to see how Enzo Maresca deals with that squad over the course of the season, because João Felix didn't even come on yesterday. And you can imagine someone like him who's just come in for big money. Pedro Neto obviously come on, but and Nkunku, these guys won't be happy sitting on the bench for when you go to Anfield and play in Liverpool. So it'd be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out over the course of the season.
One thing I think Maresca's got in his favour, though, is that he's hit the ground running better than anyone thought he would, to the point now where Chelsea went and had the lion's share of possession at Anfield yesterday, and they only had two shots on target. I know they didn't get Palmer into the game, but Jackson scored again. I think it's easier as a manager to have the backings of the fans to play your 11 and bring your subs on when you want, when you're playing well. And I think Chelsea, Loro, are playing better than what we thought they would, and therefore Maresca's probably got the faith in the fans that if that's his starting 11, he can do what he wants.
Yeah, and he was quite brutal at the start of the year as well. Much was made about his bomb squads that he made, full of high-profile names. So he's not scared of that kind of squad management. And they've always looked quite good on paper. I don't think the problem has been the quality of player that they've got. It's just been making them do it on the pitch. And I think he's been maybe slightly lucky in the fact that, I think, to quote Tigal, they were trending towards the start of last year and started to make improvements under Poch, and he sort of left, but obviously the players had already started that upward turn and they carried it on this season. They've been really lucky with Cole Palmer, I think, because I don't think they quite knew they were going to get that much of a star when they signed him. And yesterday was just one of them where we sort of thought, well, let's have a little look then. If you win this game, then you're really serious. But if not, no problem. You know, I don't think they were massively outplayed. It was just Liverpool just looked like a stronger side at home and probably a little bit further on in their development as a top Premier League side. But in all honesty, I think the signs are really good for Chelsea. And like you say, Nicholas Jackson scored again. He's someone that came in last season who looked good, but looked like he couldn't finish. That was one very obvious attribute that he needed to work on, and I think he's done so brilliantly. And now he looks a real potent threat. Like you say, two shots on target, Jackson's put one of them away. So I think the signs are still good for Chelsea, albeit probably a good, really good season for them would be getting into the top four.
Definitely, yeah. You say about crossroads moment, Tommy, there, but I'm not sure Liverpool, City and Arsenal are there. They're rivals this season. I think if you offered Maresca fourth, and I think we've spoken before, haven't we, that fifth might potentially even be a Champions League space. With the quality of the squad that they've got, I think they should absolutely smash that Conference League to bits. So should be playing Europa League football regardless next season, but he'll be aiming for Champions League football. And just a lot more positive signs for Chelsea than maybe where they have been over the last few years.
Yeah, definitely. But the way I was describing it with a crossroads, I was just thinking in my head, like, if Chelsea went to Anfield and won that game, we'd be sitting here having conversations about, oh, is it a four-horse title race now? Just because going to Anfield, probably one of the hardest places. Well, it is one of the hardest places to go and win. If they did turn them over and in impressive fashion, then it looks like, okay, maybe there's a conversation to be had that they're in the title race. Whereas now it's like, yeah, they are a level below, and we all thought that anyway.
Did I see you tweet earlier, Tomo, about Cole Palmer? He's like signed an 8-year deal at Chelsea, hasn't he? Did he say something about like spending the majority of his career at Chelsea? Was that a statement he made?
I'm not sure if it was a statement. I think it was more of a question by a journalist from Telegraph. And given the fact he signed a 9-year contract about 2 months ago, and he's what, 22, 23?
Yeah.
He basically just said, look, I'm really happy. I'm happy with where the direction where the club's going, and I'm not looking at moving at any time soon. But the headline reads, I want to spend the rest of my career at Chelsea, which I hope he doesn't.
Yeah, I've earmarked him as like going back to City or like one of those sort of Barcelona, Real Madrid style players that they come for when there's like a real great English player. So I was surprised when I read that headline. But I think, as you're rightly saying, if you sign a 9-year deal, then the context is that you're there till you're 31. Then yeah, that is the majority of your career. So no, that makes sense. Cool. Moving on, boys, to the Vitality. Another red card for Arsenal, this time William Saliba. That following on from Declan Rice at Brighton and Trossard at Man City. They've dropped points in all of them. I've seen a couple of journalists, and particularly Gary Neville, speaking about how if Arsenal want to win titles, then they're going to have to win games with 10 men, which I think was something they used to do a lot under Arsene Wenger. But Laura, do you think this kind of ill discipline is threatening to ruin their Premier League season?
Yeah, of course. They're giving themselves too much to do, aren't they? They already gave themselves 45 minutes at the Etihad to try and hold on and then end up coming away with a point. But if you do it time and time again, you know, the well will run out of water, won't it? And it was already a step too far going down to 10 men so early on Saturday, because they never looked like they were going to stay in the game after that. It just felt inevitable that Bournemouth would get the goal that they needed or two in the end to get the points. And I just thought, you know, one thing about a title contender, we've championed Arsenal's title credentials a lot. One thing you need to be is quite savvy and make sure that you get over the line in different ways. And I just thought bringing down a player as last man in the first half, they'd be far better off just letting him go for and score. You'd still back Arsenal to win the game from that position with 11 men on the pitch. Now you almost throw the points away, and they've got to have probably one of their most important players out for the next three games. So that decision, whether it was right or wrong, I think it was on the edge, was a poor one from William Saliba. And although it's a split-second decision, the top players make the right calls in those moments, and he didn't. So not a good weekend for Arsenal, particularly you bring in the context of Liverpool winning and obviously City getting a last-minute winner as well. So that will hurt. And now they find themselves joint, I think, with Villa in third and fourth place. So lots to do for Arsenal. Really disappointing weekend for them in a game that I don't think they ever really looked like winning, which will give Arteta lots to ponder.
And Tomo, we're going to speak a little bit around refereeing decisions and VAR, but we've kind of covered two games that have had two very similar incidents there, where you had the toss-in bringing down Jota in the first half for Chelsea against Liverpool, and you've had Saliba bring in Evan Nilsson down for Bournemouth there. On the face of it, look like very similar incidents, but do you think that the ref got both decisions right there? Do you think there were differences enough there for one to be a red and one to be a yellow?
Absolutely, yeah. And I just spoke briefly then about how the Liverpool team sort of mirrors the image of its manager. Well, the Arsenal team seem to mirror the image of their fans on social media, because both are collectively losing their heads time and time again this season. And obviously Saliba loses his head in that decision to bring Evan Nilsson down. And then, yeah, just you these incidents over the course of the weekend, and because I'm basically spending all my time on social media with Football Tweet, etc., I'm sort of canvassing the Arsenal fans throughout the weekend, and they're just slowly losing their minds with every sort of incident that goes against Arsenal. So you start off with that Saliba one, and they're all saying that Ben White was in line and he will get across because he's really quick. But obviously that's not the case. Referee can't take into account the fact that Ben White is quick to his decision making. It's William Saliba is the last man. There's no defender around him. It's going to be a sending off. It's a correct decision. Then you fast forward it to the John Stones decision, and obviously he heads a really important goal. He heads them into an important 3 points in a 95th minute, and obviously Bernardo Silva stood in front of the goalkeeper, but he gets out of the way in time and gets completely out of the way in time for just Stones to head the ball. But the Arsenal fans obviously collectively lose their shit over that as well. Just because it's for a team that they're directly rivaled with. And then you obviously fast forward a couple hours, and that toss-in incident, which is obviously the most similar to Saliba, and Colwill stood right next to him. So I actually think it was the completely wise and correct decision to just give him the booking. And I don't want to get all bloody sort of psychological about it, but I find it quite interesting how we collectively lose our minds on social media about stuff like this, where like the sort of the discourse on social media over these incidents. You saw it a lot last season with like the Forest fans and even the Forest Twitter team when they said that the PGMOL are employing Luton fans as the referees, etc. in those games. Like the discourse is like fans need someone to blame for something to happen, and like it's not that the referees made a mistake; it's that they are corrupt. Do you know what I mean? It's like the referees are intentionally giving Man City decisions and they're intentionally giving Arsenal bad decisions. And it's like, I find it quite astounding that that is the sort of the society we're living in now, where people have just collectively completely lost their minds. And you can almost sort of relate it to like politics in a way, and like the rise of conspiracy theories and like fake news and distrust in like authority, basically. That's what it is. We no longer trust our politicians. We no longer trust the police. We no longer trust referees to make the right decision. And it's like, it's absolutely insane. And I'm pretty sure that once this podcast goes out, we'll get a couple of comments saying that you're an absolute knob for talking this way about Arsenal fans. But it does feel like, maybe because of Arsenal Fan TV, but it does feel like Arsenal fans are like the worst for it.
I think Arsenal fans are absolutely like desperate for Premier League as well. They've come so close both times. And so when you lose 2-0 against Bournemouth, which we know how, you know, relentless City and Liverpool can be in title races, where actually it sort of gets to the stage where dropping 3 points is a massive moment. Yeah, you don't want to blame your players, do you? When you love, everyone loves, every Arsenal fan loves Gabriel and Saliba so much, you don't want to put the blame at the door of William Saliba, who, as Lauro says, made a real rash decision rather than letting a striker go through, who, by the way, is very impotent striker so far. And David Raya is a brilliant shot stopper, so could have just saved the one-on-one. Rather than blame your favourite centre-back for making a rubbish decision, you land it at the feet of ref and VAR.
Well, it was a collection of errors, wasn't it? Because it was Leandro Trossard who played the ball, and it was and then Saliba, who's trying to make up for that error, obviously inadvertently makes the foul. But yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I just think it's society. You just always need someone else to blame for your own failings, maybe. And probably we're as much guilty of that as them. But I actually think the biggest thing about Arsenal's first half display was they've done well coping without Martin Odegaard so far. And obviously he's had the injury. But Bukayo Saka was out, wasn't he? And Arsenal, when you do go down to 10 men, you need to be really good at counter-attacking. And Bukayo Saka would have been very important for that. And if you look at, I think Saka's made the most assists in the Premier League this season. I had a look before. He's created the most chances and created the most big chances. So yeah, you can cope with like losing Martin Odegaard, one of your biggest creative forces. But then when you add on top of that Saka, then you're really struggling and your back's against the walls double time. So he was a massive loss, and he will definitely need to be back in the team for this Liverpool game on the weekend.
That game is coming up as well, isn't it, at the weekend? I'm not sure if we'll have a pod in between, so we should probably just cover that fixture off, because it's at the Emirates and we've spoken about Saliba's going to be banned now. We don't know whether Saka's going to be fit enough, bearing in mind Arteta sort of mentioned that Saka might be available to start that game, and then he wasn't in the squad, and Odegaard's out. But you know, if you're Saliba, Saka and Odegaardless at home to Liverpool, Lauro, then that kind of gives Arsenal a bit of an uphill battle straight away, and they're already 4 points behind Villa. You get to the stage where you're almost calling that must win.
Yeah, it probably is for Arsenal. I think before the context of the injuries and suspensions, you'd have said Liverpool would have bitten your hand off for a point, but they might be going there smelling blood now, because there seems to be a little bit of a mini meltdown over losing to Bournemouth, maybe some referee decisions, no Saliba, hopefully Saka will be back. You know, I think Hazard and Martinelli were close to not being fit. Odegaard's been out for a while. So this is a phase they're going to have to get through, Arsenal. And quite often it will come by picking up 3 points in a big game like that against Liverpool. So they'll be hoping they can use that kind of fortress Emirates that they've created over the last couple of years since the success of the Arteta teams to sort of bounce back and put themselves back up amongst it, because it is a six-pointer, obviously. They can get three and make sure Liverpool don't. But that will be an interesting game, because Liverpool look really decent at the moment, and they're not the sort of team that really play for draws. They've got some really good attacking outlets, and the likes of Mo Salah love it on the big stage. So when it comes to the weekend and that game gets played, it'll be really interesting to see who's in the starting lineups and which way the pendulum swings. But it's great that we've got a proper top of the table clash that doesn't involve Man City, that's for sure.
And though Arsenal obviously had the red card and Bournemouth that smelt blood and won it, I think worth calling out how well they did as well. Like to win 2-0 against Arsenal regardless is a massive result.
I thought that Semenyo looks like a proper player. I think he's what he. I think he scored 3 and 6 now this season. He was quite wasteful at the weekend. I thought he should have scored 2 or 3, but he was quite imposing on games, a little bit like Eze and Elise for Palace in that sort of mould, where you think if he carries on like that, he's going to end up getting himself a move into the sort of next echelon of the Premier League, I think, because he looked really like too hot to handle for Arsenal at times, who have been very good defensively over the last few years. So he's one that I thought stood out, albeit lacked a bit of end product at the weekend. If he can find it, he'll find himself getting on the end of a big move, I expect.
One of the most satisfying things about that game as well was Bournemouth's first goal, the set-piece goal, because Arsenal, we speak quite a lot about their set-piece coach and how well they defend and do on set-pieces. And for Bournemouth to, obviously they've been working on something like that over the last week or so in the training ground. For them to do that and it just come off so sweetly, that left-footed strike was just absolutely perfect. And it sit really well with me, and I really wish that Sky, I think it was Sky who hosted the game, just zoomed in on Arsenal's set piece coach after it.
Do you know what? Since you said, Tomo, on a pod recently about the set piece coach sort of off out their chair and celebrating and on the camera when a set piece goes in, that's cropping up more and more. I saw another one on Match of the Day, and I'm trying to think who it was. It might have been the Leicester set-piece coach when Ayew scored, which I know is a big moment. It's 98th minute, so, and it's obviously a well-worked routine that he puts in the bottom corner. But there's definitely a rise in their ego, isn't there, of them like celebrating like a routine coming off when set-pieces have been worked on for, well, probably the history of football.
Yeah, and that's a really good segue, Murph, into... but yeah, I do think they're narcissistic wankers and I have no time for them whatsoever. But that's a good segue into that goal, because what was he doing? Celebrating Aaron Ramsdale's, like, I'm sorry, but Aaron Ramsdale has been the most disappointing player of the season for me, for Southampton. He's come in on big wages. I think he's their most expensive or their most highly paid player. And if you, I just watched the highlights just then, and that arguably he, okay, the second goal is a penalty. But when you actually look at Jamie Vardy's penalty, it's not that good. And Ramsdale just looks tiny in there. And then the first goal, he's nowhere to be seen. And then the third goal, I'm sorry, you've just got to save that. And I was having a look at a couple of the stats, and there is an argument. I said to you boys in the chat beforehand, there's an argument that he is the worst goalkeeper in the Premier League right now. And actually, his save percentages kind of backs that up. It's only 59%, which is the 19th in the Premier League. The last place is Alfonso Areola for West Ham, and his is like 58%. Coming in at number one is Alisson at 88% save percentage. So that's what, 30% difference? And yeah, Ramsdale, I don't know, he's having a bit of a stinker. I know it's difficult when you're playing in a team that are probably going to get relegated. And obviously, in the two seasons before he joined Arsenal, he was relegated, wasn't he? Once with Bournemouth and once with Sheffield United. And I actually think it's not really a prediction. It's probably a spoiler, but he'll be relegated for the third time this year as well.
I'm not having that. If you're going to come and make a comment like Aaron Ramsdale, there's an argument for the worst in the league, I want you to have watched a lot of him this season for Southampton. And to say that you've watched a bit of Match of the Day and then had a look at the stats, I mean, the save percentages, I would imagine if you look at the stats on, which probably don't exist, which is why you've actually got to watch players to decide how good or bad they are, Southampton will be conceding, I promise you, way more clear-cut chances than what Alisson is having to save for Liverpool. I promise you that. So he also made an unbelievable save, Aaron Ramsdale, just before the penalty that a lot of keepers wouldn't have made. And then Vardy went and I think it got blocked on the line and a pen was given, I can't remember what for. I agree that I thought the third goal was a little bit of a howler for him. But this is a guy that, as you say, got relegated with a couple of crap teams before, but was still thought highly enough of to be bought for big money at Arsenal. Still thought highly enough of to be taken with England for a couple of tournaments. And is someone that's got a really good kind of reputation, I think, in the world of goalkeepers. So he's at Southampton, I think, because he found himself in a little bit of a rare situation whereby he was replaced probably stylistically by a big club rather than not being good enough. And goalkeeper is a position where generally people will have a settled choice. So he's ended up at Southampton in a team who, like you say, are almost definitely going to get relegated and have a really, really poor Premier League team at the moment. And I think I said at the start of the year, I think it was just a year too early for them to come up. I don't think they thought they were going to go up probably this time last season, and they've ended up going up through the playoffs. Russell Martin's having an absolute howler. And a lot of the goals they concede and the chances that they concede are from really messy kind of playing out from the back situations that always lead to horrible one-on-ones and situations like that. So very, very harsh, I think, to be discussing Aaron Ramsdale as one of the worst keepers in the league when he's just been given to Southampton, who are a really, really poor team. A little bit of a hospital pass for him there, I think.
Yeah, but you did allude to his time at Arsenal, and obviously a difficult season last year for him. We spoke around this time last year, we were speaking a lot about him and David Raya. And it doesn't take a leap of faith to suggest that he's lost a lot of confidence in that year, obviously with Arteta basically backing Raya. And he's gone into Southampton, the pressure's on for him to deliver. And not only that, but they put him on massive wages. He's the highest paid player at the club. I think, yeah, okay, I only watch Southampton on Match of the Day, but fuck me, I'm a Man United fan. I'm not going to sit there and like watch Aaron Ramsdale not for 90 minutes every week. But
you're happy enough to call him the worst keeper in the league?
No, but this is what we do, don't we? We make statements, we have opinions on watching Match of the Day. It's just what I do.
We want to make valid statements.
Well, that's why...
Not coming for players.
That's why I backed it up with his save stats, which he's 19th in the league. So obviously he's one of the worst. And I agree with what you're saying, that the chances that Southampton are giving away are going to be more threatening than the likes of Alisson and Liverpool. But when you look at the replays of that third goal and you see a couple of the defenders and you see the way they're looking at Ramsdale, it's almost like they're almost going, come on, Aaron, you're the highest paid player at this club. You need to be doing better than that. And that's where I'm at with it. And actually, if you've watched him over the last sort of 6 weeks, he has made a couple of really poor... Well, I wouldn't say he's made some absolute howlers, but just like that third goal, he should be doing better on quite a lot of the goals he's conceded. And that's my opinion.
Okay. Any other examples? Because I agree that the third goal that he conceded at the weekend was poor. But to form an opinion that strongly, I would imagine you've got two or three kind of examples of where he should have been doing better, like this goal here or this goal there. If you want to come back to it another time.
Yeah, the first goal against Leicester on the weekend, I thought he was absolutely woeful in defending that cross. And even, even the penalty, he just looked like he looked so small. And I think sort of anyone could have scored that pen. And yeah, I know it's a penalty, so that's very harsh, but...
Just a bit. What about the save he made before the pen?
Yeah, but that's okay.
Unbelievable save. Unbelievable point-blank header save from Aaron Ramsdale, who, for me, when I think of Aaron Ramsdale, he, more than quite a lot of other goalkeepers in the Premier League, comes up with these unbelievable saves. I always remember one he made against Leicester a couple of years ago. I think it was a Maddison free kick. Yeah. And if you're in the Premier League, you've got a job to try and keep clean sheets. But when you're standing out and making top-class saves like that, there's no wonder Arsenal bought him and he's up there with England. So I think he made a little bit of a mistake on the third goal. I agree that was a poor one to concede. I think it was a big leap to go from that to the worst in the Premier League.
I know Alisson sort of has higher save percentage, but him and Edison must face such a less volume of shots as well that actually they do every so often make mistakes, don't they? Like Edison can be really reckless with like rushing out of his box, and Alisson's had a couple where he's made mistakes. So every keeper makes mistakes. And then if you're Aaron Ramsdale and you faced 18 shots against Leicester and conceded three goals in that game, they've then conceded three before that against Arsenal, three before that against Bournemouth. He probably faced such a volume of shots that he's made maybe 6-7 saves per game. And it's just the sheer volume. You're always going to make a mistake every so often, which is going to be highlighted. So it probably comes with the territory of being down there.
Yeah. And on top of that, when Alisson and Edison make the mistakes, they're playing in teams that can more often than not get them out of it. And they might win that game 3-1 or 2-1 or 3-2 or whatever it might be. And then you don't really, on the Monday, you don't really pick through that mistake too much because they've won the game. Whereas maybe I am being a bit too harsh, but it was 2-2 in the 96th minute or whatever it was. And okay, it wasn't like an absolute howler, but I'd want my keeper saving that. And it was clear that the Southampton defenders wanted him to save it as well.
Yeah.
They were down to 10 men as well, by the way, Southampton. I don't think Ryan Fraser did them any favours. They were probably all looking at him, wondering why he's taking up a paycheck as well. If you want to discuss the worst players in the league, he must be up there at the moment, but probably most of them at Southampton are as well, because they're having an absolute train wreck start to the season, to be honest with you. And poor Aaron Ramsdale in goal, being told that he's 20th out of 20 because he can't get near Vardy's penalty. He must be sat there shaking his head.
I got one I put beneath him, Robert Sanchez at Chelsea. Got no stats on it, what his save percentage is or metrics or anything like that. I think he is constantly making massive errors, it feels like, either playing out from the back or shots that shouldn't be going in. I checked earlier to see why they're not playing that Petrovic who was in goal for them last year, but he was starting for Strasbourg at the weekend against PSG, which probably is part of the reason for it. So yeah, they had someone called Bettinelli on the bench as their keeper, but I know they've got about 15 keepers in total, Chelsea, but I can tell you now they need a 16th if they are going to be Champions League club again in the future, because they've got the likes of Cech and Kudacini and Courtois as their previous keepers, and he's not up to it, Robert Sanchez, I'll tell you that much. Look, while we're on the Leicester-Southampton game, Laurie, you made a point that from a points perspective, we're starting to see a little bit of a gap forming already with a four-point gap between Everton in 16th and the team they beat at the weekend, Ipswich, in 17th on 4 points. We got Ipswich, Crystal Palace, who've made a shocking start to the season under Oliver Glasner, albeit have got a game in hand tonight. Southampton and Wolves both on 1 point. Do you think that we're starting to already see a bit of a makings of a four-horse race to go down?
Yeah, and I actually think, like you say, Palace have got a game tonight that you feel like they've got a little bit more quality than maybe the rest of the contenders down there. It could very easily just turn into Ipswich, Southampton and Wolves, I think. Ipswich are the sort of team that, like, even if they get a point somewhere, everyone's saying what a good job McKenna's done, because, like I said at the start of the season, on paper, they've actually made quite a lot of signings since then, but on paper, they should never be there. So it's almost like they could get relegated and not lose any stock whatsoever. But Southampton and Wolves are Premier League clubs who will be hoping to do a lot better than be on 1 point after 8 games. So they're in desperate need of something to go for them. And they're probably both clubs that are looking at the manager at the minute, which is not nice because two young English managers, but that's probably the reality of it.
Yeah, Ipswich, I thought, would have earmarked Everton home as a game that they've got to win if they're going to have any chance of survival. So to lose 2-0 is a bad day for McKenna. But yeah, nice to see Sean Dyche starting to get a few points. I think they're unbeaten in 4 now after beating Ipswich. They drew with Newcastle, beat Palace, drew with Leicester. So Everton starting to pick up, because I thought they were in for a really another dark season. But it looks like certainly the Ipswich and Southampton and Wolves, I'm going to hold off Crystal Palace until tonight, are going to be struggling. Tomo?
Just before we move on to the EFL, I just wanted to shout out, I know Fulham lost on the weekends, but I just wanted to shout out Raul Jimenez, because he seems to have found his goal scoring form again, which is nice to see considering he obviously had that horrific head injury. I think he scored 5 goals in his last 7 games for Fulham, scored 4 in the Prem. He's outperforming his XG, so he's obviously doing really good things. And to be honest, given Rodrigo Muniz's sort of goal scoring form last season for Fulham, I did think Raul Jimenez would struggle to get into that team. But he's come into the team this season, and it seems like he's getting somewhere near back to his best that he was showing at Wolves before his head injury, which is, I think, I speak for everyone when I say it's nice to see.
Yeah, and we've got a friend of the pod who's a Fulham fan who was absolutely staggered that he wasn't on the penalty. Just wants Jimenez in goal scoring form to be taking that penalty, because Andreas's penalty was Pereira's penalty was an absolute disgrace, and easily saved by Emi Martinez, who is a world-class keeper, but big moment in the match that. And Villa went on to win that comprehensively.
Agreed, yeah, but just on that penalty decision, that's the first handball, I think, of the season in the league, and it was an absolute disgrace of a decision. I don't know how Matty Cash, he was literally half a yard away from the ball where it's headed. I don't know how he can move his hand away from that ball. So, Yeah, Andres Pereira's penalty was piss poor, but justice done, in my opinion.
Yeah, so that the only bad decision of the weekend from a VAR perspective then, Tomo, there was one, we kind of spoke about it throughout the games. The other one I just wanted to mention involving United was De Ligt coming off just before the corner, before Ethan Pinnock scored. Obviously, De Ligt got booked. I think Ten Hag got booked and Johnny Evans got booked for protesting about him coming off. But to me, seems like if you've got blood coming out your head, that's pretty black and white that you've got to go off and get that stitched up.
So what I mean about the culture of having to blame someone else other than yourself. And it's like, that was the third time that De Ligt had come off the pitch to try and sort of get that head injury and that blood cleaned up. And if you're going to blame anyone, blame the medical team, because they needed three attempts to, I know it was obviously a bad cut, so I don't know, but like surely just wrap it up. And yeah, it just felt like Ten Hag and Van Nistelrooy, and I think Darren Fletcher's landed himself in a bit of hot water with the referee for giving him a bit of shit at halftime. So yeah, it's just one of those ones where you just want to blame everyone but yourself. And the reality is that the referees and the officials made exactly the right call and the medical team needed to do better.
The commentator on Match of the Day, when the goal went in, was like, said something along the lines of like, oh, that will be controversial. That's the space that De Ligt would have been in for the corner. And I'm thinking, well, I'm sorry, if your best header of the football and your centre-half's come off for a corner, you bring someone back from up front if you leave two up there. Or you say to someone who's on the post, like Dalot, look, no, actually, you're going to mark this space because this is the most important space because it's where our best header of the ball normally is. You don't just let Ethan Pinnock ghost in at the front post and head it in just because your man's off injured. You've got to adapt to that while someone's down. It's not the first time someone's had to be off for a set piece with an injury. So you're right, just looking to blame anyone but the fact that United didn't adapt to the fact that he had to be off the pitch.
That's a microcosm of football today where like players rarely think for themselves anymore. They just get told what positions to be put in every single aspect and scenario on a football pitch and on a football game. And they just go into that position no matter the situation. And obviously, De Ligt coming out, you saw it on the highlights. The goal was just in his position. Surely, a leader, a goalkeeper, anyone, take charge of that situation. And like you just said, fill that space. But no, everyone doesn't want to be that man. They just want to do what the managers or the coaches are telling them what to do. And then what happens? Pinnock rolls in and scores.
Yeah. Well, look, we've got midweek action coming up in the form of Europe. I think we spoke about Liverpool at Leipzig. We've got Arsenal at home to Shakhtar. And I think City are home to Sparta Prague in a 9-0 victory. But United on Thursday night, Tomo, back to Turkey to take on Fenerbahce and Mourinho in charge there.
Yeah, that'll be a tough game. You can see how sort of raucous the atmosphere will be. And we've spoken on this podcast time and time again about how weak mentally the United players seem to be. So even if we go 2-0 up in the first 15 minutes of that game, I still don't back us to win because something will happen. A bad challenge will happen. The crowd will get on top. And it feels like United, they got a bit of a... they crumble quite often. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see. It'll be a good game, I think. And obviously, with all the drama surrounding it, with Mourinho, I think Fred plays for them as well, doesn't he? So, that'll be interesting to see. Yeah, exactly. So, it'll be interesting to see the midfield battle with two former United players coming up against Casemiro and Ugarte and the likes of that.
Yeah, no Bruno either, suspended from sent-off in Porto. So, I wonder if we'll maybe play Eriksen in the 10. I think the only game Bruno's not started this year was the Barnsley game, which albeit weren't the strongest opposition, was probably the best we've played from an attacking sense. So I'd be really interested to see how we do on Thursday night. Look, let's move on to the EFL. And we previewed on the pod last week the fact that it was Leeds versus Sheffield United. At the time, it was fifth versus second and Sheffield United were unbeaten all season. If honest, probably the least confident I've heard you, Laura, about Leeds in quite a while. But they were great value for their win on Friday night in the end.
Yeah, well, I will say I've maintained throughout the season since a couple of games in that we're going to win the league easily. My concern was I think Sheffield United have got some really good match-winning type players, particularly Gus Hamer, who I think is very good. And we were missing Gruev and Ampadu, our two first-choice centre midfielders. And just generally looking at football, if you lose your best two centre midfielders, you think you're going to be in for a more difficult night, particularly if the opposition's good. However, Tanaka and Rothwell have come in, and people are already saying it's going to be difficult for Ampadu to get back in because they just absolutely controlled it, both of them. Both of them, just neither of them seemed to be deep lying or attacking. They were just doing everything. Old school midfielders like Tim Sherwood would like, bit of attacking, bit of defending, bit of tackling, bit of passing. And they just ran the game, completely ran the game. Sheffield United weren't in it from minute one to 95. And it should probably, again, should have been a lot more. But even Chris Wilder, who normally absolutely despises Leeds, and we seem to get in his head more than the other side, afterwards just said, look, we deserved absolutely nothing from the game, and that's the best side that we've played by an absolute mile. And I think when you look at Daniel Farke being able to bring off the likes of Nonto and Ramazani and bring on Dan James and Manuel Solomon in the Championship, there isn't much in the way of competition, I don't think, when you look at squad depth in the league. So a very, very pleasing night, a game that could easily be a classic Elland Road banana skin, but we got through it with flying colours, 3 points and marching on.
Laura, yeah. can I ask you about Manuel Solomon, actually? Because I was interested in his move from the Premier League. I thought he was class for Fulham, and obviously he's dropped down a division. What's he been like since he's been down there?
Injured predominantly, but he I actually thought him and Nonto would probably be the starting wingers, but that Ramazani, who apparently used to play for Man United before we signed him from Spain, looks like Nonto just on the other wing, so he actually might struggle to get in. But I agree, Manuel Solomon had a spell in the Premier League for Fulham where he scored, I think it was 4-4, and they were all exactly the same, cut in and bent in with his right foot, and one of them was against Leeds, so that may even be where the link started. But like you say, if you bring in a player of that calibre on off the bench in the Championship, then I think there's going to be a lot of worried teams. So I was really pleased that we could get through that game with 3 points and kind of send a little bit of a message, I think, to the rest of the league that we're starting to get going and we're not even at full strength yet. So unbelievable signs.
Midweek fixture list as well in EFL, with it being European games and Watford home on Tuesday, Lauro. So be looking for 3 points again there.
Yeah, honestly, I tweeted this. I might have done it off our account, but just to the Leeds one. This is the... We also had 2 years in the Championship. We've had one with Farke, and this is his second. Out of all four of them, this is the most confident I've ever been that they'll win the league. Not because I think it's the best side. It's possibly on paper the worst. It's definitely got less quality in it than it did last year with the likes of Somerville and Rutter. But I think the overall competition and calibre of competition in the league is slightly lower this year. And I just think we're really fundamentally sound all over the pitch. We're not like a gung-ho team anymore. We're really balanced. And every single position has got one of the best players in the league. So that's where my confidence comes from. And I'm looking at Sunderland at the top of the league in a minute. And I was speaking to another friend of the podcast yesterday who's a big Macum. And I said, I think they'll be in the top six come the end of the year, Sunderland. But I think they're on a bit of a crest of a wave. And I think it will end at some point. And I think they've been quite lucky to get some of the points that they have. Obviously, they had that nightmare Leeds goal go for them and earn them a point the other night. And I think they had a contentious goal yesterday against Hull City as well. So if that's the biggest challenger in the league, again, it just sort of rubber stamps my point.
So you're in third place, obviously Sunderland top, the Wilson Isidore. I think he's got 3 goals in 7 now. So he's on loan from Zenit for Sunderland, but was a little bit controversial. But in second place, you got Burnley, who are probably the other side who'd be tipped to be going up with you. Lauro, they're 2 points ahead of you, scored 16, only conceded 4-1, 2-0 at Sheffield Wednesday at the weekend. But you still back Leeds over them.
Yeah, we've played Burnley at home and they beat us 1-0, but we absolutely battered them for 90 minutes. And I'm not just saying that as a bias. It's only 10 games gone. There's no need to get too headstrong about it, but we battered them for 90 minutes. And I don't mind losing to a counter-attack goal 1-0 every now and again, as long as we're going to put it on teams. And 9 times out of 10, we'll win the game. That was just one of those classic games where you've thrown the kitchen sink at it. You've had probably 95% possession. You've had 20 shots and nothing's gone in. And they've broken away, had a good moment and scored. But we're better than them. I've watched us play them. I've watched Burnley a couple of times this season. They'll be a good side. They'll be in the top six. Josh Brownhill, fantastic Championship player. They've got Jaden Anthony, who I think scored at the weekend. We saw him at Leeds last season. He's been promoted with Bournemouth before as well. Plenty of quality in that side. I think us... them, Sheffield United, like I've said, there'll be a surprise package at some point, and I'm sure Sunderland will be there. But I really don't think any of them are going to compare to Leeds. come the end of it.
No, it's fair enough. And just to call out as well, we spoke about Portsmouth, who hadn't won all season, in a bit of a bottom of the table clash against QPR. They actually won that game 2-1, Callum Lang penalty in the second half, enough to win it. And they played Cardiff, who were also in the relegation zones alongside Portsmouth, now both on 8 points. Midweeks, they'll be looking to go back to back there. I've just seen when looking at the table that Coventry are in 21st place on 8 points. I just always thought, as Mark Robbins being a great manager, you had them close to in and around the playoffs and close to promotion. But looks like they've had an awful start to the season, considering he was on the cusp of beating Man United and getting them to an FA Cup final.
Always slow starters, though, Coventry.
Yeah, they are. They well, the fans don't seem to be happy there. There was a viral video that I saw online of Robbins sort of squaring up to a fan who was giving him shit in the crowd. So obviously not all's well there. But I just wanted to pick out another result that I guess was quite important, was Middlesbrough 0, Bristol City 2. Now, my missus's family won't thank me for saying it, but I think I can speak for us all when I say that was a nice result, given the fact that Liam Manning is currently not in the dugout because he's taken a leave of absence because his recently born son Theo sadly passed away, which is so tragic. And obviously for the assistant manager to go to Middlesbrough and get that result, it was just nice to see. And if you look at the sort of stats and the highlights of that game, Middlesbrough absolutely battered them. So it felt like it was a nice game and a nice result. I just wanted to sort of pick that one out.
Yeah, no, nice touch. Good win for Bristol City, and important as well, because that takes them into the top half, and they're only a few points off the playoffs now. So hopefully when the time's right for the gaffer to come back, they take back over them in a good position, because they're obviously a fairly local side to us, Bristol City. It'd be great to have a side in the West Country in the Premier League one day. Moving on to League One, boys, and Laura, there was a story that you earmarked to chat about a bit of a good news story for a striker at Wickham who was plying his trade in non-league but has now moved into the professional ranks and is joint top goal scorer now.
Yeah, and I have to say I'd never heard of him until very, very recently, and I think the reason for that is because he was just playing in like Essex, I mean, not Sunday League, but definitely non-league and non-professional football up until literally this year, 24 years of age. I think the stories are that he was sort of brought up in maybe the Ivory Coast or somewhere in Africa, very, very humble beginnings. I think a lot of homelessness involved, came over and started ripping up the sort of district or county leagues in Essex, but wasn't given a work permit, so he couldn't play football professionally. Eventually, Wickham got it over the line at some point this year, and now Wickham are third in the league, and he's the top goalscorer in the league. So I think he's got a hat-trick at the weekend as well. So that's someone to keep a close eye on. And a little rough diamond like that, a little bit like Bundu at Plymouth. They're always sort of cult heroes at clubs, and hopefully that can be a really good success story, albeit they're in a league with some very, very hefty competition, obviously, with clubs with big, big money. So nice to be able to speak about someone other than Wrexham or Birmingham this week.
Yeah, well, Wickham are the team in third behind Wrexham and Birmingham, as you touched on there. But actually, worth mentioning that the gap between third, which is Wickham, and 12th, which is Charlton, is only 3 points. So you've got a cluster of about 10 teams there, all within 3 points of each other, which is obviously pretty classic for League One and League Two. But yeah, some midweek action there as well. Birmingham versus Bolton. You've got Wrexham versus Huddersfield, which is second versus sixth. And you've got Barnsley versus Charlton, which is 8th versus 12th as well. So we've got some big games there midweek involving sides in the top half of the table. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of moving about in that League One table come 10 p.m. on Tuesday, Wednesday night. In League Two, Port Vale won again. They're absolutely flying under Darren Moore. We've actually got a lad on loan at Yeovil at Port Vale that I'll ask Laurie to comment on in a minute, that we're hoping to keep. But yeah, Laurie, Darren Moore, someone who I personally thought wasn't probably the right fit for Port Vale and wasn't going to do a great job, but they seem to be absolutely flying and sit top of the table.
Yeah, they did spend quite a lot of money. They brought in quite a lot of decent League 1, League 2 type players. And I think maybe one good thing about having Darren Moore is the fact that he is quite a high profile name. So maybe that was part of the club's thought process. They could attract some slightly better players, and they just look really, really strong, don't they? And like you just said, we've got James Plant on loan from Port Vale. And if that's the kind of player that isn't getting anywhere near their squad, than the rest of the players they've got there must be absolutely terrific. So good to see Port Vale at the top. I don't think that they're home and dry, though, because there's lots of good clubs in that league that are much of a muchness. And I think, like last year, we'll see it sort of go back and forth. We were talking about Mark Bonner's side, Gillingham, who had a really good start to the season, faded away a little bit, but still in sixth place. Bradford, Notts County, massively two clubs that are still up there. Doncaster in second after that really good finish to the year last year, where they won sort of 12 games in a row. So teams like Chesterfield as well on the periphery of the playoffs, who were the pre-season favourites. So very good start, but we are, what I will say is we're only 12 games into a 46 game season in the EFL. Yeah. So there's lots of sort of conclusions that are made at this point about how good a manager is or how good a certain team is when let's see after another 12 games.
As you say, while Port Vale are winning with the squad that they've got, then means we can probably keep hold of James Plant a little bit longer. So good luck to the Valiants at Harrogate tomorrow night. And just one other fixture to highlight in midweek with some of those teams that you just touched on towards the top of the table is Barrow take on Notts County, with both sides in the playoffs in that as well. And then a bit of news that I probably wasn't expecting to be talking about this week, but apparently ASAP Rocky is in talks with a consortium to buy Tranmere Rovers. And I saw someone put a tweet out that means that the chances of Rihanna meeting Mike Dean have peaked higher than they've ever been, which is a conversation that I'd love to be on a fly on the wall for.
But have you seen as well, a part of that deal is rumoured to be like a sort of Wrexham-style documentary as well. And it goes to show how valuable English football is nowadays. And the Wrexham example is there for all to see. You get these two high-profile owners come in, make a massive documentary. We're in the attention economy. And now Wrexham, I think I mentioned this on the podcast before, but now Wrexham, behind Inter Miami, are the most well-supported club in America. Do you know what I mean? So obviously, ASAP Rocky and Rihanna are obviously seeing the success of that and trying to get involved.
Where do we think that ends, though? Because like we've had the Salford one, haven't we, which was sort of a bit less of like a Disney Plus documentary and more of like TV series and had that sort of Class of 92 part to it. We've got the Wrexham one now. If there was a Tranmere sort of version of it as well, like, are we just going to see a future where we've just got investment from music stars or movie stars into English game in lower leagues, and we're just going to see documentaries out on all the streaming platforms, and the money comes into the lower leagues through that, and they're, you know, buying, they're in the, they are in the National League and they're buying League One players like Mullin going to Wrexham? Like, do we think that that's going to be the future of the game?
Well, I don't know the figures in front of me, but I guarantee that Wrexham probably earn more money from that TV series than they do from the gate receipts in League One, or the TV revenue that they do from Sky in League One. Because Disney will be spending a hell of a lot of money each year to produce that series. And I mean, let's have it right, it's a really good series. So the people who, like the fans who are watching that, I don't know how many people view it every year, but it just becomes more valuable. And it's a League One club. So if ASAP Rocky and this investment team take over Tranmere, I don't know exactly the geography, but Tranmere are right next to Wrexham, aren't they? So they'll be neighbours.
Yeah. What worries me a little bit is, like, if they're basing it on the Wrexham one, not only is the Wrexham one kind of the first of its kind in this country, but it's also been very successful, which obviously goes hand in hand with a successful documentary. I do worry about clubs like Tranmere, if they're taken over by very high profile celebrities, if, you know, it doesn't go quite so well on the pitch and Rihanna is having to sack Nigel Adkins in the boardroom on a Tuesday night after losing 1-0 to Grimsby, how long is their kind of commitment going to be to those clubs? And is it going to be a little bit of a toy whereby Tranmere has not worked, a little bit of a football manager where they just close the laptop and all of a sudden you've got an institution there on the Wirral, a very good club with a big stadium and a good fan base, who are going to be left picking up the pieces because ASAP Rocky and Rihanna haven't quite got the footballing logistics right? So hopefully they get things right, but like I said, the thought of Rihanna in the boardroom with Adkins,
well, the thing is that
a 3-0 Oscar FC Wimbledon is just very funny.
Yeah, there is a slightly sort of darker, cynical side to it, where obviously there's an investment firm behind ASAP Rocky and he's just used as the face of it to promote it. And the investment firm are obviously there for one reason and one reason only, and that's to make money. So, but obviously that goes hand in hand with a successful football team. So I get if you're a Tranmere fan. If this has happened to Yeovil, you'd be excited, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, I said I actually think Yeovil are the sort of club that might be primed for an approach like that. Sort of good history shows that it can be a big club. We are geographically surrounded by no one. So a fan base could be 10 times bigger probably if you pulled in a lot of the other kind of towns half an hour away that don't have a big football club nearby, like when we were in the Championship. And like I said, we've been up in those dizzy heights before. So yes, I'd be very excited if that happened at Yeovil. But just to be balanced, yeah, I mean, just to see Rhiannon meet Nigel Adkins would be worth the documentary for me.
That would be where my concern is. It's like all of these documentaries say the Wrexham one probably does more than what they bring in through the gate through Disney Plus, but end consumer for those streaming services will ultimately be whether it's a successful series or not. Would everyone watch the Tranmere version of it? And then, you know, if the Birmingham story with Tom Brady gets turned into a documentary, all tuning in for that. You've got Sunderland. I know that wasn't sort of celebrity investment, but you had that Sunderland Till I Die series. There might just come a point where maybe it will be one celebrity too many. You know, someone comes and buys Harrogate and it suddenly doesn't work for them. The documentary bombs and that might be the end of it. But it just feels like we're seeing a lot of that sort of happen now. What celebrity you got in your head buying Harrogate, Lauro, and it bombing?
50 Cent buying Crew, getting it horribly wrong.
Just get an interview, Rich or Die Trying.
Yeah, it'll have to stop somewhere. But I'm not surprised. Tranmere is not a club I'm surprised. They're sort of like, obviously they're in League Two, but we've been there, haven't we? Prenton Park is quite a big stadium, kind of on the edge of Merseyside there. So maybe they'll be able to get that going. But I think we've got to be careful that they're not all just going to be like Wrexham.
Yeah. Well, look, we'll keep our finger on the pulse with that story, and you know, maybe one day we'll have ASAP on the pod to chat through his thoughts in the Tranmere boardroom. Right, let's move on and finish up with our regular YTFC update from Lauro then. So Saturday saw a much-needed big win for Yeovil at Wealdstone. Lauro, just talk us through it.
Yeah, 3 goals away from home against struggling at Wealdstone, who are managed by Matty Taylor, Barclaysman, maybe. You'd probably put him in that kind of category, a couple of long-range strikes back in his Portsmouth days. Ripped him apart, to be honest with you. But we've been quite good at that this season. We've beaten all of the teams. I think we've won 6 games and 5 of them were the bottom 5. So that's not a bad thing. You want to be beating the teams down there. And it was nice to get a few goals, particularly one into Aaron Jarvis, who's our centre forward and was kind of like our blue chip signing in the summer, if you like. He got an assist as well and got in the Ranarama team of the week. And it sends us up to 8th place, 2 points off the playoffs. So sometimes when you're sort of milling around mid-table, it can go one or two ways. And the next stage of the season, you're either looking over your shoulder, you're starting to get a bit excited. And it's actually the latter. And we go to Tamworth tomorrow with Maidenhead at home on Saturday. 2 probably be tough, but winnable games. And if we can get 4 to 6 points out of those, then YTFC could be looking at another promotion jaunt. So I'm actually trying not to sound too excited, but I am starting to get very buzzing for what this season could entail. So 8th in the league, Tamworth tomorrow. Check back in next time to how we got on against the Lambs.
And I think on that note, we will end it there. As Lauro says, we'll be back next time where we will check in on all of those games that we've previewed and any further upcoming fixtures. But boys, pleasure as always.
Cheers, lads.
1, 2, 3.